This is the Jeff Horovitz Show on 97.1 The Big Talker.
All right, we've got Representative Brett Roberts, Senator Michelle Eugenie Reedy, Mark Howard, and a bunch of news items. Jeff Horovitz Show starts now. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for listening. Jeff Horovitz here. Happy to be here with you today. Hope you all had a great Easter, and we're starting off Monday with a bunch of guests today. And I kept stacking up the news items over the weekend. I shouldn't do that. And then into today, there's so much to talk about. Representative Brett Roberts is coming up in a second. We're going to start with him. He authored the bill that would make these vaccine passports illegal in Arizona. You know, we talked about it a bit on Friday. Talk about it again. Plus, Senator Michelle Eugenie Reedy on House Bill 1 and this voting rights issue, what it means for Arizona. And Mark Howard's going to join us. We've got some grievances with the National Forest Service, as well as a bunch of other issues. Mark, a regular contributor now, always appreciate his insight. And if you've got any comments, love to hear from you. The Just Wireless listener line open just for you, 877-971-3971, 877-971-3971. But let's welcome back to the program, Representative Brett Roberts. Representative, how you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me on, Jeff.
Good weekend, Easter. It was warm. I was down in the Verde Valley, and it was actually getting hot, 92. You're down in the Phoenix area. It was like 197, I think, officially. Something.
So, I don't think it was quite 197.
Okay. Unofficially. Okay. No, it's cranking already. It looks like it's going to cool down, though. I always get a little nervous, Representative, this time of year, because we already see these fires kind of hitting up around the state, and that always scares us, especially up here in back in Flagstaff in high country.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Roberts, House Bill 2190, that's going to ban vaccine passports in Arizona. I saw that Governor DeSantis, once again in Florida, is leading the way. He did an executive order saying that you can't have vaccine passports in Florida. We always seem to be a little behind here with some of these, against some of these states like Florida and Texas. You're trying to stop that. You came up with this bill. You saw this coming. Explain, I guess, first of all, and I've done this before, but we may have a new listener, may have not heard this. What is a vaccine passport?
Well, a vaccine passport is kind of what has been labeled or dubbed if a business were able to basically ask you for your medical records in order to determine if they were going to do business with you. Now, namely, this is, coming about in response to, COVID-19. For me, this is not as much about the vaccine aspect as it is the aspect of a business being able to ask you for your private medical records before they determine whether or not they want to do business with you. Cause that, that's, very personal information. And I don't think it should have anything to do with whether or not an individual can participate in commerce, because, you would be looking to, if we were to implement this, and, this is something that started in New York, and now the Biden administration is, talking about this in the media, like they want to try and get this done, when in reality, there's a much simpler solution the administration could be calling for liability protection for businesses, like much like we're doing with Senate Bill 1377 that Senator Vince Leach sponsored. We passed that out of the House just recently. I believe that's going to the governor at this point. I'm not sure if it needs to go back to the Senate, if there was any changes made. Okay. But that's a solution to protect businesses versus trampling on individuals' private medical information, which, really kind of begs the question, is that what this is really about? Is there some other reason that they want to be able to do this? What that might be, I'm not going to speculate on it at the moment, but I find it problematic to let a business say, hey, you can't come in. We're not going to do business with you. You can't get on the bus. You can't get on a plane. You can't go to a concert or enjoy a football game if you don't have this vaccination. Well, you know,
it puts a lot of people in a bad position, Representative Roberts. And I was talking about this with your colleague, Representative Chaplick, on his mask freedom bill, which sits at the governor's desk, I guess. I don't know if he's vetoed it yet or not. I hope he doesn't. But that put businesses in conflict with regard to the mask issue. So now I think this would ramp it up even more. I don't know how many people are not going to get the vaccine, maybe a quarter, who the heck knows. But could you imagine the confrontations that may arise? Because people are asking, let me ask, for your papers, basically.
Exactly. And that's, I referred to this in committee, and since then, probably a time or two, I can't help but think about this from the aspect of all of those movies that I watched in the 80s and 90s, where, you know, you have an individual driving across a geographical checkpoint, and they ask you for your papers. This is exactly like that, except it's going to be tenfold worse. Because this is every business that you want to do business with would have the opportunity to ask you for this if this were to be ushered in and become commonplace. You know, COVID started a little over, you know, became rampant and, you know, really a big thing a little over a year ago, probably year and 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, something like that, and then progressively got worse. And for the longest time, when I say worse, I mean media hype-wise and everything. But we kept hearing that, you know, we got to get a vaccine, we got to get a vaccine. And now it's like, not only did we have to get a vaccine, but now we have, now they want to mandate that everybody takes the vaccine. And, you know, now I'm an individual that, you know, I have a daughter that's about to be 3 years old. She has her vaccine, her vaccinations. My wife has got the COVID vaccine. My mother-in-law has got the COVID vaccine. I have chose not to. That's me. That's my personal choice.
Yeah.
You know, for me, this is a vaccine that is not currently FDA approved to my knowledge. And so, you know, it's a very personal decision. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that we should be crossing this line. It's a very slippery slope where businesses can start demanding that you do certain things with your health in order to, you know, be able to, especially when we're talking about, you know, a virus that has, from what I'm told, a 99.8% survival rate. You know, this is,
we've altogether gone over those figures so much. I mean, it's there right in front of us, Representative.
Yeah. I think this is all about fear. And this is, you know, now the pushback that, the predominant pushback that I'm seeing is we, you know, shouldn't be interfering in, the rights of a business and how they choose to operate their business. And, you know, under normal circumstances, I'm right there. I'm a pro-business, legislator. I back businesses all the time. However, when it comes to a situation like this, you know, this is not, I think this is very similar to, and people should make note that when people use that argument that prior to the Civil Rights Act in the 1960s, businesses back then in the South tried to use that very same argument in order to be able to discriminate against people based upon the color of their skin. And we now have the Civil Rights Act that, you know, outlaws that. And I think this is very similar. You know, medical privacy should remain protected. And if we, you know, the Civil Rights Act already determines that businesses can't discriminate based upon race, I don't think we should be able to discriminate based upon whether or not somebody wants to relinquish their medical records. I think that's a step too far, in my opinion.
Yeah, Representative Roberts, let me back up here a second, because you said that a lot of your family has gotten the vaccine and you chose not to, because automatically if you say you're opposed to a vaccine passport, people will probably, and maybe the so-called media is already labeling you as an anti-vaxxer. That's not the case, though. I think that's why you gave the example of your family.
No, I am not an anti-vaxxer, and I stated that in committee. What I am is somebody that respects the individual's right to keep their medical history private. Mm-hmm. And whether or not they choose to get a vaccine is their private medical records, and it should be kept to them. You know, the last time vaccines came up in Arizona, I think Senator Bartow ran a bill in regards to this. It was a very, very hot topic. It touches people, you know, in a very intimate way,
yeah,
if you
personal.
Will.
Yeah.
It's very personal. There's many people that have reached out via email, and we had an event on the lawn in front of the legislature. People that have had family members injured via vaccine and things of that nature. And, you know, there are certain people that are adamantly against it. And I respect that point of view. I don't think, you know, I don't want to be the person that says, you know, you have to do this. And then one of their family members gets injured from a vaccine. And, you know, that's just not a path that I want to go down.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, my wife and I chose to have our daughter vaccinated, when a child is born, they go through that normal process, and, you know, she's had all of her vaccines, but she has not had a COVID vaccine. I don't intend to have her have one anytime soon.
Okay.
Now in the future, maybe when these vaccines have been vetted for a considerable amount of time, you know, longer, maybe a year or two or something like that, then maybe I'll reconsider, but at the moment, I don't intend to, and I don't.
And people want to maintain that choice. Look, I just had Easter dinner with family, and some of the folks I was with were vaccinated, some weren't, and everybody was fine with. Everybody knew that, and everybody was fine with that. And it does get scary when people say, hey, you can't participate in society unless you do X, Y, Z. New York's gone that route. I had the publisher of the Trends Journal on last Thursday. He lives in New York, and it's a disaster. He loves beautiful state, but he's like, I can't stand it here anymore. I think there's that battle that's forming, Representative, between the states, like maybe Arizona, hopefully, but Florida, Texas, these states versus the New Yorks where people are fleeing, and the Californias that'll probably have these vax passports. And then maybe it'll all have to get litigated and go all the way to the Supreme Court, which takes years as far as if they can even do this.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you say that, because it depends upon how this were to try to be implemented. If the Biden administration chooses to do this via executive order, I have another bill that would help us get through that path.
Yeah, give me that
being
bill.
Able to challenge
this. Give me that bill. HB 2310 you're working on. This is more on the national side. What's it about, Representative?
Well, that's in regards to unconstitutional presidential orders. If the Biden administration were to do an executive order, which they have done many so far already in his short time in office, this would create a path in the state of Arizona where someone such as myself, a legislator or a group of us, can basically challenge this. And it would, once we got an opinion from our legislative council, assuming the opinion came back that they agreed that it was unconstitutional, we would then refer it to the Attorney General, the State Attorney General, currently Brnovich. And if the Attorney General's office determined it was unconstitutional, then they may file a declaratory judgment in federal court.
Okay.
So it's very similar. It was based upon a law that South Dakota did. I changed it up a little bit because we had concerns whether or not a state attorney general could really effectively overrule a presidential executive order. Because in reality, I mean, a legal opinion is a legal opinion. And until that legal opinion is adjudicated in a court of law, it's just an opinion. So we set the path to get into the court system. Kind of felt that would be the best route to go in order for the law to be, if it were to be implemented, to be in, you know, signed into law and be effective and not be challenged in court.
Yeah, and Representative, and folks talking with Representative Brett Roberts, Biden has done so many executive orders. The one that we're all watching, and by the way, folks, for Open Line Wednesday this week when we take your live calls, two full hours of your live listener comments, John Kistler is going to be with us. He's heavily involved with the Arizona Citizens Defense League. Second Amendment is a big one that people are concerned about that may trample on even states' rights when it comes constitutional rights, but then states' rights on the Second Amendment.
Right. Yeah. Representative, the majority whip, Leo Biasucci, we passed a bill, HB 2111, that I was a co-sponsor of, and also offered an amendment on that I believe has went to the governor at this point, that would make Arizona a Second Amendment sanctuary state.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
and that's what John Kistler is working out on a countywide basis. Arizona Citizens Defense League and folks within that organization, was counties were starting to do this and declare that.
Very familiar with AZCDL. I'm a life member. Have worked with David Kopp in the past, and love the organization. Was monitored what they did prior to my involvement in the legislature. It's a great organization.
Good. All right, Representative Roberts, real quick, the House Bill 1377, that's the liability protection for COVID lawsuits and potential frivolous COVID lawsuits. Businesses are very concerned with that. As a small business owner myself, you said as well, and many folks that are listening, that is on the governor's desk.
Well, I know we passed it out of the House last week. Okay. I don't know if – I think there may have been an amendment in the House. And if that is the case, then it'll need to go back to the Senate real quick, I believe Senator Leach will probably concur. I'm not certain on that, but have to double check.
Okay, yeah. If you get any updates on that, just text me, and we'll also reach out to Senator Leach, who's been on the program before, because that's really important. I mean, to get the economy really roaring and people not as nervous, it's a super important bill. Okay, Representative Roberts, right now the vax, what's the state of the making the vaccine passports illegal? It went through the House. It went over because we had Senator Townsend on, and I think she's a supporter of this as well. She was on Friday, and there was maybe an amendment. Does it go back to the House? Where's this thing at, and what should folks do? Just email the governor, email you guys?
Yeah, well, the bill in the Senate, Senator Townsend was very helpful in introducing the Stryker amendment onto my bill. Mm-hmm. I asked her to do so because the original subject matter of the bill wasn't moving forward any further. I got something out of that through negotiation, and because the bill was already in the Senate, I could put the new subject matter, the Stryker language for the anti-vaccine passport, on there. So I asked Senator Townsend to do that. It currently has went through the Appropriations Committee. There's some more work that needs to be done to it before it goes to the floor, so there will be a floor amendment. And assuming it makes it out of the Senate after the amendment is put on, it would have to come back to the House for a vote, because when it left the House, it was a totally different bill. So it would definitely have to come back and be voted on in the House before it can go to the governor. To answer the second part of your question, your constituents and your listeners, basically, if you are interested in this and you want to see this happen, I encourage you to email your representatives and your senators and the governor's office to make sure that they know how you feel, that this is important, that you don't want your medical privacy rights to be trampled on, and make sure they're aware of that.
Absolutely. All right, Representative Roberts, hey, just keep us up to date on this one going forward. A couple of really good bills there, and we appreciate that. Whether people are for the vaccine or against, it's more of a personal issue and personal choice, and everybody should be behind that. So I guess, I mean, I can't speak for everybody, I guess, but I am. All right, Representative, appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll talk with you real soon. And folks, we still have Senator Michelle Eugenie Rita coming up, plus Mark Howitt. Plus, I'll try to get some of your comments and a bunch of news items. Hang tight. Back in a minute. right, folks, welcome back. Jeff Orbitz here. Love to hear from you. Chime in on the Just Wireless listener line. Leave your comments today, and of course, we'll have Open Line Wednesday. 2 full hours of your live listener comments. John Kistler will join us, and I believe former Flagstaff Mayor Jerry Neighbors, both to answer all your questions, and we always look forward to Open Line Wednesday. But in the meantime, send your comments or leave your comments, 877-971-3971. 877-971-3971. I'm going to hit on some news items this segment that I piled up throughout the weekend. And coming up after this segment, we'll have Mark Howitt, a bunch of issues to talk about with him. Plus, Senator Michelle Eugenie Reed is going to join us on some big bills that are making their way down on the Senate side down at the legislature. Big legislative update today, trying to keep you updated on as things rapidly start to wrap up down there, because as they get in deep into April and then into May, they move to the budget and then the session's done. So we'll see which bills live and which bills die down there. Okay, so like we were talking about, Florida Governor DeSantis is leading the way once again. We were just talking with Representative Brett Roberts, and the governor has issued an executive order in Florida. I think he might be the first one in the country to do this, banning any Florida government agency from issuing this so-called, according to this article from Fox, vaccine passports, and banning any Florida business from requiring customers to display such a passport before entering. Just what we were talking about. Now, I almost asked Representative Roberts if the governor should just do an executive order, but I didn't because I thought it through in my head, and I'm thinking no, because it doesn't have that power of the legislature making a law. So just as a governor can make an executive order to do this, another governor down the line can just easily undo it versus going through a legislative process. So I think Representative Roberts and his supporters are on track here to, you got to get this passed through the legislature and get it to the governor's desk. And you know, is he going to follow Governor DeSantis? And this has been my criticism of Governor Ducey this whole way through. He seems to be nudged along very easily by people saying, do this, do that. He gets hit from both sides, and then he buckles to both sides, and he manages to make everyone mad in the process. Now, I think he's been trying to undo that. And many of you have asked me, what's the governor doing? What's Governor Ducey doing? His term's up in 22. What's his political intentions? I have no idea. Is he going to run for the Senate seat coming up in 22 against Senator Kelly? As you know, Congressman Biggs has already declared for that seat, as well as I think there's going to be a bunch of people piling on this. I don't know what his political future is, but I sense, this is just my opinion, that he's trying to claw back some of that real conservative edge that he used to have, especially in his first term. But I don't think it's working, because he keeps getting kind of outdone by these other governors, like in Texas with Abbott and DeSantis in Florida. My point being, he just seems to always lag behind and kind of follow these guys that are really leading the way on these issues. So we'll see. We'll keep an eye on this bill and see what happens coming up as far as the vaccine passport. Sticking to this topic, the CDC travel recommendations. I pulled this one off the Daily Wire. According to the CDC, people are considered to be fully vaccinated 2 weeks after their second dose in a two-dose series, such as Pfizer or Moderna, and 2 weeks after a single dose, such as the Johnson & Johnson one. And the CDC now says fully vaccinated travelers are less likely to get and spread COVID-19. Well, that's good. CDC confirmed its recommendation that people who are fully vaccinated with an FDA-authorized, notice that doesn't say FDA approved, which I think a lot of people have been noting on this show lately, that it really shorted the whole approval process. But anyway, the FDA authorized vaccine can travel safely within the United States. Well, thank you. And as my screen goes black, and that full vaccinated travelers do not need to get a test or a self-quarantine if they are fully vaccinated or have recovered from COVID, or this is an important one, or recovered from COVID-19 in the past 3 months. It added that people should still follow the recommended travel recommendations, which is to wear a mask. So you still got to wear that mask. I know some folks that have gotten COVID and have gotten the vaccine. So I don't know if you just get like eventually you get like a t-shirt or hat or something that says, hey, you can just do what you want and you don't have to wear a mask. I don't know if that day's ever coming. On the airline front, because a lot of people are now once again traveling by air, Delta this past weekend had to cancel over 100 flights because pandemic travel has now soared. This is according to Fox Business, that 100 flights were canceled on Sunday stink if you're trying to come back from Easter, because of staff shortages, according to the reports, blah, blah, blah. They apologized to their customers. Basically, the travel numbers when it comes to air have now gone up to more than a million travelers, going through U.S. airports each day for the last 20 days. So it's really spiked up. But still, March traffic, this past March, still remains down nearly half from the period in 2019 when travel was really, really booming. And I believe that there was something like, I had seen numbers 2.5, 3 million people were flying before this. So we're still at a million. They say half, but I've seen numbers that were much higher during holiday seasons. So people are traveling, but not as much going forward. Let's hit on a couple more articles here. And if you got a comment, love to hear from you. Talk with Jeff at iCloud.com. Here's an interesting one. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, we've all kind of picked her as the leader of the leftist and the Democrats. And she comes up with some of the craziest policies. But I guess how effective are her policies in Congress? Is she getting anything done? And there's this article from the Jerusalem Post. Quote, she introduced a lot of bills, but she was not successful at having them receive any sort of action in committee or beyond committee. And if they can't get through committee, they cannot pass the House, of course. This was someone, a Vanderbilt political scientist and co-director of this organization that did the study. And the title of this article is AOC is among the most ineffective lawmaker in Congress, according to the study. Maybe she's just probably just misunderstood, I guess. But I guess that's good news. So there's some good news for you on a Monday is AOC is the most ineffective, one of the most ineffective members of Congress, because maybe let's be hopeful here. Let's be optimistic. Maybe even some of the folks on the left are realizing that she's out of her freaking mind. Here's one on the financial side. Janet Yellen is pushing for a global minimum tax on corporations. This is from CNBC. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen will call for a minimum tax levy on corporations around the world in an effort to keep companies from relocating. Yellen will tell the Chicago Council on Global Affairs conference that establishing a minimum global corporate rate will help bring stability and provide a more level playing field for all countries. Yeah, I'm sure that will be the effect. The remarks come as President Joe Biden is looking to raise the corporate tax rate here in the U.S. To cover his $2 trillion infrastructure improvement plan. And they're looking to raise the corporate taxes. Remember, President Trump did a lot to bring back corporations to America who really fled to more tax-favorable places. Ireland comes to mind, but there's many others around the world who have very low or zero corporate taxes. So what does that do? It creates a international marketplace for whatever you think about these companies that leave and shelter the taxes off overseas. It really does show you that if you open it up to competition, people will flee. So they're trying to lock that in with a minimum tax. They're basically saying, hey, we have to come to agreements with other countries that we all have a base tax rate, so the field is level is what they're going to say. They're doing this because they're getting ready to raise the corporate tax rate from 21% in the U.S. right now. They want to raise it to 28%. So that's a significant increase. And they also want to increase the offshore rate. Currently, these offshore companies, they can pay 10.5%. They want to raise it to 21%. So how is this all going to help? These people are a mess. I'll tell you what, they keep raising the taxes. They're going to keep raising the taxes until they raise it on every single one of us right on down the line. All right, folks, love your comments. Go ahead and chime in on the Just Wireless listener line, 877-971-3971. Plus, love to get an email from you. I look at all your emails, and I try to get through as many as possible and get them on air. Email talkwithjeff@icloud.com. Talkwithjeff@icloud.com. Still to come, Mark Howitt. He's got some gripes about the Forest Service we're going to talk about. Plus, we will talk with Senator Michelle Eugenie Rita. Hang tight. Back in a minute. All right, folks, welcome back. Chime in on the Just Wireless listener line, 877-971-3971. Also, email talkwithjeff@icloud.com. You may have email questions for my next guest, a frequent contributor on the program, Mark Howitt. Mark, hey, how was your weekend? And it was a beautiful weekend. You still working in the Sedona area? It might be getting a little crisp, a little hot. You're getting a little hot, but that's okay.
Yeah, our construction business is wrapping up in Sedona for the year.
Yeah.
We'll be hanging out in Flagstaff, but it felt like summer up here. I mean, we barbecued with the family after church on Sunday and, you know, just had a good time eating some ribeyes and enjoying the, you know, 70-degree weather. It's pretty incredible.
Well, I did this, and actually you and I were texting pictures of OSB, because that's what people do on the weekend,
right?
Like us, apparently.
Then OSB picks back and forth.
Yeah. Well, I built this little, like, just covering. Let's call it a tiny little carport for, like, the four-wheeler. Nothing big. And it wound up costing me just for, I believe, 3 sheets of OSB and some 2x6 and a couple of posts. That was it. And a couple of, you know, straps, things like that. I didn't even buy the roofing material. You know, I was just do like a roll roofing and some tar paper. I haven't even gotten that. It was close to $400 for that. I mean, it was 45, 50 bucks a sheet for OSB. So I happened to find one in the shed that I must have bought like pre craziness here that was $15, and I was like, wow, I was trying to sell it to you.
Yeah, it's Jeff, it is going out of control. And for those who don't know, OSB is oriented strand board, so it's almost like a recycled product. It's wood chips and glue, not as strong as plywood in my professional opinion, but you know, last year we were paying $9 a sheet, you know, we're talking pre-pandemic.
Wow.
And it's gone up to over $40 a sheet. And there's a lot of things driving that. You know, we had the fires in the Northwest. You had a lumber yard shut down or a lumber mill shut down because of the fires. And, you know, some issues up there. And then you have to rebuild the houses and such that were destroyed. You had the hurricanes. And then you've got the boom on top of all of that. You know, the housing boom that's going on right now.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, plus the, you know, COVID supply issues, you know, people taking off. You know, a couple of weeks at a time because they get COVID.
Yeah. And you sent a picture. You must have had $1,000 worth of fly. Don't give out your address because there might be bandits coming.
I know. You know, we you know, take apart old stuff, you know, remodels and old decks and stuff. And I can literally just put the lumber on Craigslist, the old lumber, and people come take it away. You know, where it used to go to the dump. And this is kind of a good thing. You know, it's being recycled by people for their sheds and whatnot now, which is good.
Sure. Yeah. I wonder how many people are using like a bunch of pieces though to build houses. Like if you saw my shed, I have like a bunch of 4x4 pieces. I just on the inside just pieced it all together. This is an older shed I did, and I was like, I just need so I can nail stuff up. It looks pretty like gypsy, but nowadays it's like that's some real money there. What are people, I've heard stories that the cost spikes in building. Have you seen this personally, or have you heard of this? Are some people canceling their house order or whatever you want to call it, saying, hey, I'm not going to do this now because of the cost overruns?
Well, what I have heard of is builders, especially in the Valley, who pre-sold houses to people at a fixed price, have realized now that they cannot build the house for the money they told the person, and they're just having to go bankrupt, basically, is saying, sorry, we cannot build your house because it's going to be a loss for us instead of a profit.
Yeah.
And so I've heard of that through the grapevine. You know, other people who are locked into contracts that stipulate that they'll have to eat the extra material costs are coming up with, you know, they're getting a $50,000 bill on top of everything else on their house for the increased lumber cost. So yeah, it's ultimately the consumer is going to eat it. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Yeah, well, I just did the math real quick on just like a roof, say, if you want to sheathe that roof, it must be $3,000+ just for the extra cost of the material for that for an average house. I mean, probably more.
Oh, yeah.
And that doesn't include
the
all
roofing
the other
materials
stuff.
Have gone up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. And rates are slowly rising, but I don't know if that offsets that cost over a 30-year note. One other issue here that regarding building, and folks talking with Mark Howitt, the solar issues, and I saw an article that I think you'd probably like. There's the new Hummer coming out, the GM. Remember, they discontinued this thing as a take on the military Hummers that were big back in prior to the bust of 08, really, everybody would get these huge Hummers, gas guzzlers. You still see some driving around. Well, apparently they have the new electric ones coming out, and they're like, I saw prices over $100,000 for this thing, and they're big and pretty bad, I guess, 700 plus horsepower. So I was thinking, well, it's finally in Flagstaff, they were mandating the EV plug-ins in the garages. I was like, finally, you know, I'm glad I spent that extra couple $1,000 or whatever, $1,000 for that plug, because now you can plug in your $100,000+ Hummer. It's good.
It's right. Yeah.
Pretty average person.
And, you know, as you know, I consult for the city on these things. And they actually brought me in specifically to consult about the Tesla charger, as we're calling it, in the garages. And it's trying to plan ahead, because when you go to add these things afterwards, it can literally run you $5,000 to add the Tesla charger in your garage after your house is already complete.
Yeah.
My electrician just completed one for somebody, and it was over $5,000. And the reason for that is a lot of the older homes, the breakers are full. You have to run a new sub panel going all the way across the house. Full of wire now is almost $500. Just for the wire itself.
Oh, yeah, because the copper price and everything's gone up, too. Yeah,
copper price has gone up, you know, doubled. And so, you know, the big move now is electric cars, but there's a lot that's driving that. And, you know, the EPA and in the EU there, I don't know what they're called, but they're making car makers meet such stringent standards for miles per gallon that the car makers can't do that. So they have to buy carbon credits. And so the bigger companies like Chrysler and whatnot go to Tesla and say, hey, you have tons of carbon credits because that's all you do is electric vehicles. We'll buy your carbon credits so that we won't get fined by the government for not meeting MPG standards. So by making a, you know, electric Hummer, electric cars, GM and all these companies can offset some of this, some of the mile per gallon standards that they have to try to meet, which are almost impossible. They are impossible now, really.
Yeah. So they did.
They've done everything they can do.
Yeah, and I saw GM wanted to be almost go to more electric vehicles, or maybe all electric vehicles in a not too far off future. But you do the carbon offsets, and I've read about this before. Somebody plants a tree in Uganda or something, and you know that offsets and you know takes in the carbon dioxide, whatever. But to me, it just sounds a little bit silly. But that's what they're doing. That's what the tax codes and all these different things say. Hey, here's the loophole, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm not opposed to electric vehicles, but we have to be realistic. And the early studies of how efficient electric vehicles were compared to gas, as far as healthy for the environment and all that, were really skewed, because they were taking current large cars that were running on gas and comparing them to brand new electric vehicles. Yeah. But when you really, if you take a brand new Honda Accord gas and compare it to a brand new similar size Tesla, they pollute just about the same, because the Tesla, it's using electricity, but it's coming from coal fired power plants, natural gas fired power plants, or even worse in some ways, nuclear plants, which, you know, nuclear is clean, but then you've got to do something with all this waste and get to the Yucca Mountain.
Storage
and all that. And so, you know, electric vehicles are not any cleaner. It's just they don't pollute locally.
Well, yeah, so, you still got to get the electricity from somewhere. And I think that's what a lot of people forget is there's still a plant somewhere that has to provide the electricity. It's not magic. Although, I mean, I've seen surveys done on people, especially in the cities. Not everybody, but some. They where's milk come from? You know, well, it comes from the store.
Right. You know, right.
Where's electricity? Where's electricity come from? I don't know. The outlet. There's no understanding of
this. So if you look at you know, very polluted cities like Los Angeles can benefit from electric cars, because it gets the pollution out of their city and then puts it off at the power plant out on Timbuktu.
Yeah.
But here locally in Flagstaff, we've got very clean air. You know, anybody that lives up here knows you don't have to go through emissions for your cars, because our air is way above EPA standards. We have clean air up here. So
absolutely.
Unlike living in the valley where you have to get an emission sticker and inspection, you don't have to do that up here.
Yeah. Okay, Mark, we only have a few minutes left, but you have a little bit of a grievance, and I have a lot of grievances that I'm going to get into this week. I was texting with former State Representative Bob Thorpe about the new firewood cutting fee permits and this whole new system or whatever, new pricing structure, looking into it more. I can tell you I'm not happy initially, though. But there's still a mask mandate on government, like national land, which we brought this up when Biden did this national mask issue on the federal property, which is your national forest. What's right. going on?
Okay, so Arizona Snow Bowl, you know, the big ski resort up here, has been required to have masks on everybody, you know, per county laws. And, you know, Governor Ducey lifted the mask mandate, basically. However, because Arizona Snow Bowl is on National Forest Service land, Biden's executive order takes precedence. And therefore, while you're riding, you know, getting in the ski lift line and at Arizona Snow Bowl, you're required to wear a mask. And I'm thinking to myself, you're outside, yeah. the wind's blowing, you're in the sunshine. This is the last place on earth you need a mask, you know, other than just living by yourself in the desert somewhere,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
It's just absolutely ridiculous. But yeah, Arizona Snow Bowl still has to enforce the mask mandate because of Joe Biden's executive order saying you have to wear them on national forest lands. And
yeah, because they've got that lease. Yeah, they've got that lease for that land basically to use it for the skiing purposes. Is yep. there something with the 6 feet thing, though? I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. Whether you're 6 feet or 2 inches to have to wear a mask out there in the forest.
Right.
But I mean, if when you're skiing down, are you supposed to be wearing it? Or is, if you come within 6 feet of someone, what is that?
Well, I know that they're enforcing it in the line. So yeah. in the line for the lift, you both have to wear a mask and stay 6 feet away. They're doing both, which is, yeah, go figure the logic on that one.
Yeah.
And anybody who knows your ski mask, you know, I've skied for years, snowboarded for years. As, by the end of the day, the thing's full of boogers because you're just a snotty mess out in the cold, right? Yeah. And you're touching it and you're pulling it up. And the real issue,
it's no good.
People's hands get so dirty from these things. You know?
Yeah.
In a hospital setting, masks work in a hospital setting because they don them in a specific way and doff them, you know, take them on and off a yeah. certain way where the hands are sanitized. In the real public world, people are wearing them under their noses. They're constantly touching them with their hands. They're transferring COVID from their mask to their hands and vice versa. And it, that's why it does not work. And it's been proved not to work. You know, when the CDC did the two mask study, that study essentially proved that one mask does not work. Yeah, it has yeah, not been working.
Yeah, you and I have talked about that. Yeah, the ship has sailed. It's like either get it or you don't. I mean, yeah. it's like I don't know. It's like skiing into the wind, I guess, or something like that. I'd use another terminology, but whatever.
I will say this, though. I will say this is, you know, the Ducey left it up to the businesses, and people are starting to vote with their dollars.
Yes.
They're going to the stores that do not require masks.
Yes, and, they are.
You know, locally, Whole Foods was really hardcore about making people wear masks, and they're backing down now because they realize, hey, people are going to go elsewhere.
Yeah.
Shop with their dollars.
You know? I've noticed that too. Yeah. People are done with it. And, you're seeing that more and more. So hopefully that's the case. Hopefully the numbers stay where they're at. Hopefully sensibility comes back. It seems like there is. I heard somebody though refer to it though. There'll be these holdouts for a long time. And they referred to back to like World War II with some of the islands where the Japanese soldiers were still there like 20 years later. So there might
fighting.
Be somebody, yeah, might be someone coming out of their house like 10 years from now saying, hey, what's going on? And we're masking up and keeping 6 feet apart.
Is it safe yet, you know?
Yeah. All right, Mark, hey, let's get you back on real soon. We'll do. We'll have you definitely back on next Monday, but we'll try also another open line Wednesday coming up real soon. Appreciate the updates. Ski on. And, hey, it is spring skiing going on, so you'll see people, I guess, with masks, and sometimes you get the bikini thing going on the slopes. So.
No.
It's
we wonder what's going to happen the last day of Snow Bowl, because usually that's naked ski day.
Oh, my God.
Is it going to be people naked with just a mask? Or, you know, what's going on?
Yeah, and Mark will be doing a live remote from up there.
All right,
Mark. Appreciate it. We'll talk with you real soon.
All right, talk to you, Jeff.
All right. And, folks, we still have Senator Michelle Eugenie Rita coming, so don't go anywhere. Hang around for that. We're going to talk about this national voter bill, the HR1, HB1, whatever they're calling it now, and a couple other issues. Plus, if you got a comment, email talkwithjeff@icloud.com. Don't go anywhere. Hang tight. Back in a minute.
This is the Jeff Horowitz Show on 97.1 The Big Talker.
All right, Senator Michelle Eugenie Rita gives us an update. Plus, I'll try to get to a bunch more news items. Another hour of the show starts now. All right, welcome back. And as always, love to hear from you. Comment line's open. The Just Wireless listener line, 877-971-3971. Also, email talkwithjeff@icloud.com. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, all of those places. If you missed the last hour, we had Representative Brett Roberts. We had Mark Howitz on some National Forest Service issues and other issues. So go ahead and sign up, subscribe to the podcast, look up the Jeff Horvitz Show. But I do want to welcome back to the program Senator Michelle Eugenie Rita. Senator, what a beautiful weekend. I hope you had a good weekend, good Easter. Back at it now.
Very kind of you. Yes, I did. It was relaxing. The Easter Bunny came. Everybody was happy. So it was good. Thank you.
The downside is you got those eggs. If there's chocolate hidden in them, I mean, you got to do the with temperatures the way they are, like 6 a.m. or it's melted.
That's exactly right.
I've had that happen before. Okay. Big issue, and we've covered it a lot on the program, has to do with the voting issues. Now, I see that President Trump, and it has to do with this Senate Bill 8, House Bill 1, and basically what I've called nationalizations of our elections, violations of the Constitution, I've had other guests call it. Mm-hmm. But President Trump was asking people to boycott some of these, I think he called them woke companies that are now saying, hey, because of the Georgia voting law that's happening. What's your take on all this, especially on H.R. 1?
Well, H.R. 1, and it's exactly right to characterize it as a federalization of our elections, because that's what it is. H.R. 1 will, in one fell swoop, with one bill, disenfranchise all of America. All of America will be disenfranchised immediately with H.R. 1. Why? Because it federalizes, like you said, elections in what? One of the most dysfunctional places in the country right now, Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
It will take the power to govern and administer elections away from local representatives, local board of supervisors and recorders and statewide elected officials, and centralize it. So there will be no way for a voter to practically influence how elections are run in their state if H.R. 1 were to pass into law.
Well, Michelle, right now, I mean, the state can decide, like if you want to do an ID, things like that. Can they set the voting age? I've heard some things in H.R. 1 that say we can let 16-year-olds vote. I mean, right now that's something a state can decide, and the Fed side would say no more. You can't do photo ID, for example. What are some of the highlights here that it would end?
Right. So H.R. 1, for example, when it comes to the ID, so it really obliterates states' reasonable ID requirements. In Arizona, the public, the people, voted with a ballot referral to codify the acceptable IDs that are required to vote day of at a poll. I did a bill in 2018 that extended those voting ID requirements to people voting in person early. Prior to that, you did not have to show photo ID when you voted in person early, only in person day of. So these are some examples of things we've done with our ID laws here in Arizona. Mm-hmm. The federal, if H.R. 1 passed, it blows those restrictions or voter ID requirements out and makes it far more loose in terms of what is required when voting. It also allows for ballot harvesting. In 2016, I passed a bill that right now is actually with the Supreme Court, but that banned ballot harvesting. In Arizona, you cannot ballot harvesting per the bill that was passed in 2016. H.R. 1 will allow it to happen, doing the complete opposite of what Arizona voters said they wanted in their election law.
Okay.
And it does that all over the country, depending on what state you're talking about and what requirements have been passed in each respective state. It completely obliterates it all and kind of applies this, you know, one size fits all states when it comes to elections. And that's not how it's designed, because we recognize that there are different circumstances, there's different situations in each state, and the people have a right to govern themselves and decide what laws they want to enact when it comes to election security.
Well, yeah, and I have a right to vote with my feet. Like, I don't know about you, but I was pretty stupid at 16. I was still honestly pretty stupid at 18 as far as when you're allowed to vote. But I would probably choose not to move to a city where 16-year-olds get to vote just because of that. I don't know. And I don't know if that would nationalize that ability for the 16-year-olds, or would that still be a local?
No, what that does, and that's in the Constitution, what that does in H.R. 1, I believe, is it allows 16-year-olds to get pre-registered.
Okay.
But really, that's unnecessary. I mean, you can register when you're 18 years old, but there are some places where you can register, you know, early, because you'll be 18 by the time the election happens, and there are states that do it that way. So this allows you to register at like 16, completely unnecessary. It also will make states move to all mail-in elections.
Okay.
Now, in the state of Arizona, we have mail-in elections, but our program is voluntary, and you have to sign up. You sign up for our system, our program, and then you are sent a ballot. Here, they want, through H.R. 1, what they want to do is just mandate that everybody be sent a ballot, regardless if they've asked for it or not.
Yeah, and Senator, we have been doing the mail-in ballots here in Arizona for quite a while. Last numbers I saw, something like 80% statewide are now getting that, 75-80%. And I think that was a big problem with the last election, was we were already kind of set up to do this, and then a lot of states were forced to do it with short notice and with kind of predictable results. It's not something you just throw on people real quick and expect a good result, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, no, that's exactly right. I mean, in Arizona, to your point, we've been doing this for 20 plus years. So we weren't overreacting to a situation like the coronavirus. We had already implemented our vote by mail system. Well, that is not the case for like dozens of states where they have absentee voting. You can vote by mail, but you have to tell them why. You have to give a reason. In Arizona, we don't. It's called no excuse absentee voting. Sometimes it's referenced that way, but you just sign up. It doesn't matter. You don't need a reason. And then you're sent a ballot. Again, that is not how every state operates. In New Mexico, for example, they don't do it that way. If you want to vote by mail, you have to elect, you have to sign up every election cycle and ask for a ballot. So again, when you use Corona, the pandemic, to then usher in massive changes to how states were voting, that is just a recipe for things to go wrong, because it's haphazard. It's not thoughtful. You know, there's a lot of kinks that need to be worked out. There's a lot of things that need to be put in place. It's rushed, and it wasn't done for really the right reasons, and wasn't done in kind of a methodical, planned way. And so you had a lot of confusion. You had a lot of people questioning the motivation behind it. You had a lot of people experiencing problems when trying to utilize it. We were fortunate in Arizona that we had already had it in place, but you can see how it was a huge problem throughout other parts of the country, because like you said, it was pushed through and wasn't given enough time to kind of develop it and implement it into your state appropriately. Yeah.
Okay. Bottom line, folks, and we've given out the email address in the past, and I think Senator and folks are Senator Michelle Eugenie-Rita, Senator, you got to email. I'm not a fan of H.R. 1, S.R. 1, the Senate side, the House bill, whatever. Mm-hmm. You better email Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Senator Mark Kelly. I think he's kind of probably a lost cause on this one, but Senator Kyrsten Sinema may be someone that maybe vote against this. I don't know, but that's probably the best thing you can do at this point is contact them.
Yes. Well, remember, they need that because of the filibuster.
Yeah.
They need the 60 votes. So we have to maintain the filibuster. And remember, they lived by the filibuster when Trump was in power. So, you know, there are people looking to change the rules of the filibuster. They need to maintain that. And yes, contact Sinema, contact Kelly, even though I agree he's probably less reliable, and make sure that your voice is heard, because this will forever change how elections are run in the most dramatic, in the most just awful dramatic way states need to be in charge of running their elections.
What happened, Senator, in Georgia with the Major League Baseball, and they said they're not going there because of Georgia's voting law that just went into effect. Similar stuff starting to happen as far as companies and big organizations here in Arizona. You referenced a letter from the Cardinals, I believe. What's going on there?
So we have a letter put out by GPL, an association here made up of individuals that own businesses or are part of the community, and they signed on to a letter urging the opposition of one of three election bills. One of them is mine. One of them is another sponsor's, and another one isn't even in moving. But the point really is here is, you know, they say that it's born out of wanting to suppress people's right to vote, wanting to disenfranchise people, wanting to make sure communities of color don't have the ability to vote as easily. That couldn't be further from the truth. It's insulting and offensive that they would even say that and put their name to something that actually makes zero sense. Because if you read the bill, particularly mine, it's mild in its scope and nature. It's reasonable. It has the support of the public. And they are bandwagoning to ingratiate themselves with the left. It's disappointing. And, we don't tell them how to run their sports franchises and their companies. And I don't think they should tell us how to govern.
Yeah. Well, what's the nuts and bolts of your bill?
So the nuts and bolts of the bill go like this. We have them. We talked about vote by mail. And we have a vote by mail system that's very popular in Arizona. And it says if you haven't, you voters, you haven't voted in four consecutive elections, you've missed four consecutive elections in a row, you'll be sent a notice saying, hey, do you still want to participate? You still want to get your ballot by mail? If you don't respond to that notice, you are removed.
Okay.
You've clearly demonstrated that you're not voting by mail. We have an obligation to have secure elections here in this state. You can sign back up if you want. You can certainly go vote in person early or day of, but you will be removed because you're not utilizing this voluntary program of receiving your ballot by mail and then, of course, voting by mail. If you're a casual voter and you're at some point over the course of the two election cycles voting, then nothing will happen. Nothing will change. You'll continue to receive your ballot automatically in perpetuity. But like I said, if you do miss four elections in a row, primary general, and fail to respond to a notice, yes, you'll be removed.
Okay.
That's what the bill does. They do this in California. They're looking to do it in New Mexico right now. Those are D states. We are flanked by two D states. One state, New Mexico, trying to champion it through their legislature. Democrats in California already have it. They have it over a different time frame. It's four general elections, but you are at some point removed. That's all we're doing here in Arizona. Very balanced and reasonable. I wonder if the people who signed on to that letter opposing these bills have even read it. Because if you've read the bill, it's hard to believe you would be against such a mild, reasonable approach.
Yeah, they probably haven't read it. And are they holding the same standards for New Mexico and California, like you said, two big liberal states?
Well, why aren't you boycotting them?
Yeah.
You know, why aren't you calling every single everyone who lives in New Mexico a ignorant racist?
Yeah. Well, Senator, stop trying to get logical here. You know, we're well past. I mean, I've got an article here. I'm not going to drag you into this one, but I was reading this article that I still have to digest. I don't even know if I can formulate words about people that use flood irrigation in some communities in Phoenix. It's racist because they have more trees. I mean,
right.
You can't make this stuff up, Senator.
No, right. I know. We are, it's, you know, jump the shark, I think what that phrase is, you know?
Yeah, it's out of control. Okay, finally, and folks, we're talking with Senator Michelle Eugenie-Rita. As the session, I mean, we're in April now. This bills are starting to fly through, live or die, some of these bills. Most of them wind up dying. And then we get into May, we'll probably be in the heavy budget time. You had a bill that we've talked about extensively, which is limiting the executive authority, not only of the current governor, but this is a future issue as well. what's the status of your bill? We're talking about this long emergency. We've had a year plus. I'm glad to see that Governor Ducey has relaxed the restrictions after a year plus, but the emergency still stands. What's the status of your bill to limit this time frame for emergencies?
Right. Exactly. So who knew, right, that these emergency declaration powers could be exploited and abused like they have been all across the country, Arizona, no exception. So better late than never with rolling back some of the restrictions under our current emergency declaration, but that should not negate moving forward with the bill to make sure this never happens again. So I have a bill that puts it a repeal time frame or end date to these emergency declarations. It says, go ahead, you can declare an emergency, governor, in the future, but it could be for no longer than 90 days. And after 90 days, if you want to extend it in whole or in part, you have to do that with a simple majority vote of both chambers in the House and the Senate. That way you have cooperation, collaboration, and buy-in from the public's elected representatives. There's an opportunity to go through the emergency declaration and make sure that it's indeed doing what it's supposed to do and not just restricting freedoms, but really addressing an emergency. And if everybody's on board and it needs extending, the legislature will vote. If there's parts of it that need extending, the legislature will vote. But if the legislature's like, look, it's been 90 days, we don't need it anymore, we can't support it, then it will expire and okay. it will repeal.
Okay.
Very simple bill.
Yeah. And this bill, though, it will not go to the governor because it would go to the voters. I believe it passed the Senate last we spoke. Is it still sitting in the House?
So, no, mine is a statutory change that will go to the governor. There's another one that will go to the voters. I'll tell you that I think it needs to be a statutory change. And let me just quickly explain why. Whenever you put something on the ballot, it's called Prop 105 protected, which means the legislature can never be changed unless it has a 3/4 vote and to further the purpose. And we wouldn't be able to, the public wouldn't vote on that until 2022. Statutory changes, I prefer because they can be addressed, revisited every time you're in session. Mm-hmm. And that's our job. Our job is to put our name and our vote on something. Our job isn't to always take the top bills and hand it off to the public. I mean, we should take a vote on this. The governor should understand where it is coming from, the support that it has, and signs it. Of course, it's ultimately up to him, but and show the public that you're either you think it's a good idea to amend the statute to make sure we don't have runaway emergency declarations, or you disagree. But the only way the public really knows where their representative stands is when they make votes on bills that impact their lives. Yeah. So I want to vote for it and use the legislative path, but there are two versions going, like I said, and we'll see what ultimately happens. Right now it's tied up in
committee in the House.
In the committee in the Senate.
Okay. Okay. Well, we'll be interested to hear about that one and the other bill that may go to the voters as we continue to progress here. Okay. Senator Michelle Eugenie-Rita, always appreciate the updates and keep us updated on the status of any of your bills going forward. And you have a good one. And session's going to end soon. So hang in there.
Right. No, I will. Thank you so much. Thanks for the time.
All right. Thank you. And folks, we still have a lot more to come. Love your comments. TalkWithJeff@iCloud.com. TalkWithJeff@iCloud.com. Don't go anywhere. Hang tight. Back in a minute. hope that if you're just joining us, Senator Kyrsten Sinema and Senator Mark Kelly is getting the message regarding, we talked with Senator Michelle Eugenie Rita here just a second ago, getting the message on the filibuster. You know, I've had a lot of guests on this issue, maintaining the filibuster in Congress, in the Senate, because if not, they're going to ram through everything, including gun control, including more. Look, they got this $2 trillion stimulus. They'll have another one after that and another one after that. And right now, the filibuster, well, the stimulus, I guess they're just ripping those through on simple majority. But the gun control bills, things like that, we need that filibuster in place. So I'll include in the show notes here, once this podcast by about 6 p.m., you can go to talkwithjeff.com, and we will put in the interview notes from Senator Michelle Eugenie Rita the email address of both Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Senator Mark Kelly, so you can email about this H.R. 1, this horrible nationalization of our elections. We've spent a ton of time on it, but also the filibuster. You may want to email, hey, H.R. 1, you know, respectfully, is not a good bill. Please don't pass this, but also maintain the filibuster. And I know they're getting hit pretty hard with that, and we need to keep that pressure going forward. If you got a comment, love to hear from you. The Just Wireless listener line, go ahead and send me a comment. 877-971-3971. Also email talkwithjeff@icloud.com. I'm not ready to hit on this issue just yet because I'm still digesting it. Just like that, I mentioned this article. I think it was in The Guardian about water issues in Phoenix. So I got to digest that one longer. I mentioned that to Senator Michelle Eugenie Rita, but it was basically that people that have trees and grass, it's like a white privilege thing, basically. That's all I'm going to say for now, because I want to read it a few more times and wrap my, I don't know if you can wrap your mind around any of this stuff anymore, but yeah, trees. Now they're going after trees, I guess. It has to do with flood irrigation. But another one that I need to research a little more, and I just want to, I just feel like I need to get this one out there as soon as possible. I got this text from former state representative Bob Thorpe over the weekend regarding firewood cutting. Those of you who have been listening to me for a long time know that I have some grievances with the way we manage our national forest. The travel management plan has been, they continue to restrict access. And if you used to be able to drive to a certain point in the forest, they push that up a mile, especially if it comes to a river or something. Then you got to hike the rest of the way. And where you used to be able to drive to these points for generations, they put up signs that say it's closed for your own good, basically to protect the native vegetation. And you're looking around and there's like three things growing. I mean, things like that. But the other grievance that I've had with the National Forest Service is, especially Coconino National Forest, is the firewood cutting. And last year during the pandemic, it was very hard for me to go get a firewood cutting permit. And I look at these national forests. They're huge, obviously. We live in the largest stand of ponderosa pine in the world. And you go out there and you won't run into a single human being. It's just tree after tree. You know my stance on it. It is way, there's way too many trees out there because they've tried to suppress the fires. And on and on. And now we're already seeing forest fires in southern Arizona, and it could be a bad year once again. So one of my complaints has been the ability for me to go get firewood, to cut firewood. And last year it was, you had to fax in or something or call the Coconino National Forest on like 2 days a week between this hour and that hour. It was weird. I never was able to get that permit. And they do things like that. I went to Tonto National Forest, and they're behind, literally fenced off, chain link fence. You can't get into the National Forest field offices or whatever they call them. We tried to get a Forest Service map. They didn't even have them out there. And my point being, the services have been greatly restricted while the rest of us are expected to be out there working and return to our jobs, or you never left your jobs if you're producing the food or providing trucks that deliver food to the big box stores or whatever. You never stopped working, but these people have like literally fenced themselves in. So I couldn't even get a trail map. So now I get this text from Representative Thorpe, which just throws, for lack of a better word, fuel on the fire, that the fee system, so it used to be it's $20 to get a fee to go cut wood in the national forest. And you could get pine, you could get, ponderosa pine, juniper, pinyon, oak, Aspen. Those are the ones that are very popular. And there's certain restrictions certain times a year for certain things, and whether they're dead standing or falling down, whatever. But it was always, hey, pay your $20 and go get, I believe it was 5 cords. You could get up to 5 cords if memory serves me right. And like I said, I'm going to do more research on this one and have a more detailed report on this. But it was, okay, 20. So that's $4 a cord by my simple math. So now it's $20. And there's also another charge. It looks like, at least from this email or this text I got from former state representative Bob Thorpe, that there's going to be additional charges per cord. And this, the permits are supposed to go on sale April 12th, according to this. It's $20. That's 12 cords is what they're saying. The cost for oak, aspen, juniper, and maple will be $5 per cord, and the cost for pine and mixed conifer will be $2.50 per cord. Purchases can be made by credit card over the phone. Oh, they're still doing that. See? They're still doing that. You can call them on Monday, Wednesday, or Friday. Like, why do I have to call to get a firewood cutting permit? I got to call them to get a permit between the hours of 8 and 12, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I used to be able to go in there and get it. Now I can't. And they have an extra charge, it looks like. I'm going to call them. We'll get the details, but it looks like they're charging extra for the type of wood you get. And have you been out there? There is so much dead, especially ponderosa, but juniper is all over the place, pinyon. It's all over the place. Have you been in the National Forest? We have too much fuel in there, and you're making it more difficult and more expensive to get firewood? You should be paying me to go get the dang stuff. Unbelievable. We'll keep up on it. But I always think of this when I see this stuff. The signs maybe they took it down because they're so ridiculous. It's your national forest. No, it's kind of like Sherwood Forest. Remember Robin Hood, the King's Forest? You can't go in there. It's getting more and more like that, and it's very, very frustrating. Anyway, your thoughts, talk with Jeff at iCloud.com. Talk with Jeff at iCloud.com. Last week, we talked with Gerald Salente. He's the publisher of the Trends Journal, trendsjournal.com. He's going to come on the first Thursday of every month going forward. He's a fiery guy, and hey, some people may not like the way he delivers his message, but he delivers it. He's blunt, and he says what needs to be said in many cases. I may disagree with him on some points, but it's good to hear that, you know, people are still willing to fight. He's fighting in New York, and New York is one of the most repressive states. They've also got some of the biggest budget problems. It's a real welfare state, and people are fleeing New York left and right. Well, I got this article, and it's talking about New York lawmakers. They are close to a budget deal. And I know New York's far away, but this has ramifications on Arizona because people are flooding to states like Arizona. You see the plates out there. They want to raise corporate taxes in New York by $4.3 billion, with a B. Want to raise taxes $4.3 billion, which if you think about it, that's like a third of Arizona's normal state budget. We're around a $12 billion state budget. And New York alone is going to raise it by $4.3 billion. Top earners in New York City would pay the highest combined local tax rate in the country. And the plan would also add, this from Fox Business, the plan would also add two new tax brackets. Income over $5 million would be taxed at 10.3%, and income over $25 million would be taxed at 10.9%. The people said of the plan, and the new tax rates would expire in 2027. Yeah, right. When does this stuff ever expire? I'm mentioning this because the exodus from states like New York is going to continue. So you're probably going to continue to see growth in populations and people moving to states like Florida, Texas, Arizona, Utah, all these states that are not going this route. I hope Arizona doesn't. I hope folks don't come here and say, hey, we just need to raise it a little bit, because next thing you know, we turn into New York. But I think that, okay, if you're a company with income over $25 million and your tax rate's going to soar that much, why would you stay there? And these are people that are probably have wealthy owners. Why would you stay there? You're mobile. You're able to leave, and they're going to relocate. So it's going to get worse and worse for states. This is my point. It's going to get worse and worse for states like New York and California, and that exodus from California is going to continue as well. And they're going to continue to come over here to states like Arizona. Oh, you see more and more of those plates out there. All right. Love your thoughts, folks. go ahead and get some emails in, and we'll get to those tomorrow during the program. You can email talkwithjeff@icloud.com, talkwithjeff@icloud.com. And please don't forget to do this. I know I've been pushing really hard. I'd appreciate it if you go subscribe to the podcast. You can do it on Podbean. You can do it on iTunes. You can do it on Amazon Music, Spotify. I may be mentioning the same ones over and over again, but please do that. Subscribe and hit like on there as well. It helps with those algorithms to keep it posted and keep it up higher in the stats, I guess you'd say. All right, tomorrow for sure we've got Bruce Sidlinger, businessman, investor, entrepreneur. His normal Tuesday visit. Plus, we're working on some other guests on some big issues, but. Listen to the promos tomorrow. We'll have that updated. And we'll see you tomorrow. I hope you have a great, safe night. Enjoy this wonderful weather. Talk with you soon.